child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter.
Someday, yeah, we'll put it together and we'll get it undone. Someday, when the world is much brighter.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to Naturalistic Support. I'm Arnell Doré, and today joining me is Elaine Durbach and Sharon Stanley. Hi, Elaine and Sharon.
Hi, Arnell.
Hi, Arnell. Sharon. Hi, Elaine.
Hey, guys. Good to have you. On Naturalistic Support, what do? On Naturalistic Support, we take a new approach to lasting personal growth and healthier, more satisfying relationships. We combine a progressive understanding of our human experience with peer support, and we help each other. This happens when you call us to talk about yourselves and to talk to each other. Our number is 212-209-2877. And today, we're going to discuss God and judgmental thinking. There are many who think of God as being infinitely loving and benevolent. But to millions of Americans, God is about order, power, exercising authority, and punishing those who offend him. This is the God widely worshipped on the Christian right, partially explaining why our president continues to be supported by the religious right, no matter how narcissistic, how authoritarian, or capricious he behaves. Today, we're asking, is it possible to reimagine God in a way that's compatible with naturalistic humanism? So let's start with the God that we have. First, there's the Old Testament God. Now, the God of the Old Testament, again and again, behaves in ways that make him seem profoundly unstable and destructive. One of the most biting and concise summaries about the character of the Old Testament God is in this brief clip from author Richard Dawkins.
The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully.
So he seemed to have a very receptive audience to hearing that. Yeah, I don't think it's all that far from the truth. But that's the God of the Old Testament, right? I mean, surely none of that is present in the God of the New Testament. I mean, Jesus is all about love and forgiveness. And, well, to some extent, yes, Jesus does seem to be a significant upgrade to Moses. But the narrative that we are all born in sin, and only by subjecting Jesus to a protracted, torturous death are we somehow cleansed, is truly bizarre. And even more incomprehensible is that apparently the ordeal of Jesus, which was supposed to absolve us of sin, is only the absolution of sin is only available to those who accept Jesus as their God and Savior. For millions of Christians, the consequences of dying without doing so is believed to result in them being eternally condemned to the fiery pits of hell, or some equally miserable outcome. Okay, so certainly there are many, many Christians who understand God as the embodiment of love and grace. But here in America, there are a sufficient number of people who imagine God to be an authoritarian who punishes and destroys his enemies. And tragically, it is this latter group who now have ascended to unprecedented political power through the Trump MAGA movement. The podcast Straight White American Jesus offers some highly insightful analysis about this. Here's a clip of Associate Professor of Religion and Social Thought at Landmark College and former Southern Baptist minister, Dr. Daniel Miller, contrasting what social science tells us about the conditions that lead people to committing crimes or to drug dependency or to homelessness versus the right-wing Christian view that it's all a matter of personal responsibility.
Trump and the right, they do not understand, and they have actively worked for decades not to understand the complex social causes of things like crime and homelessness and addiction. And I was thinking about this in academic terms. The way we could put it is that they think in terms of psychology, individual psychology, and not sociology. And what do I mean by that? In case people are like, thanks, Professor Miller, what is sociology? Sociology is the field that looks at the dynamics and behaviors of social groups. It basically looks at how groups of people work. And it often finds that group identities and behaviors, they don't reduce to the psychology of individual group members. And all anybody has to do to think about this is just think of like crowds that do crazy stuff, or when you get mob actions or things like that, and you get a bunch of people who are otherwise reasonable, regular people who do things that they would never do sort of individually. What does it mean? It just means that groups are more than the sum of their parts, that they don't often reduce to the individual psychology within them. And what sociologists and other social scientists have done, again, for decades and decades and decades at this point, is help discern patterns of social behavior that reveal the dynamics at work behind things like homelessness, addiction, immigration, crime, what have you. And they will recognize and say, if you want to address these issues, you've got to fix these bigger sort of systemic things. The right sees none of this. For them, criminality is always about the psychology of the individual involved. Dependency is a psychological failure on the part of an individual. They don't have enough willpower, or they're not a person of good moral fiber or whatever. Homelessness or poverty is due to the failure of individuals to work hard or to pull themselves up by the bootstraps or whatever. There are no systemic or social causes to these things. There are only individuals, and that's the only level they can answer to and understand and assess at. And there's a theological analog to this. I've had people, again, who reach out and say, how can good Christian people possibly support this kind of action or this kind of attitude toward homeless people or what have you? The reason is that for lots of conservative Christians, for most conservative Christians, I think especially conservative Protestants, sin is always understood as an individual moral failing. There can't be a social explanation for why people do bad things. People do bad things, it means they're bad people. It means they have a bad motive. It means that they're not a person of good character. It can't be something other than the individual.
Elaine, Sharon?
Yeah, it's right there.
It makes sense, right? I mean, you know, the whole biblical view is it is our free will that we assert to be a sinner or to be saved. It's our choice. It has nothing to do with institutions. It has nothing to do with the social fabric that we emerge in. It has to do with all, it's between me and my God and my conscience or whatever, but it's all individually.
It makes me think of, you know, of the attitude to immigrants, where there's this ruthless crackdown arresting them like criminals without thinking about why people would commit to a hellish on foot or back of trucks, you know, trek from their homes and their families and their countries trying to get into this country. And they get treated as if they're just greedy people who are coming here individually because of their, you know, out of control ambition to take our houses and our health care.
Yeah, well, the immigrant thing is, you know, it's so hard to wrap our heads around because it's not even a question of these people not having bad intentions or being being forced into a position where they have to do this unimaginable challenging condition.
Unbearable.
Yeah, but it's not just that. It's that they're here giving us exactly what we need, the labor we need that we can't supply, the children we need that we're not birthing, that it's everything this country needs to flourish. It's everything that has made us flourish in the past. It makes no sense. It's not just a question of you know, misjudging what these people's motive is, it's completely overlooking how much we need what they're selling.
And I think that you know, the if you look at what has driven them to what they're doing, what's made them come, there is that much, much more forgiving, accepting, charitable attitude. In the same way, you know, that you were saying last week, if you look at why people commit crime, so often they've come out of conditions that they had no control over.
Yeah, yeah. Let's play another clip from Straight White Jesus. In this next clip, Dan Miller explains how this right-wing Christian view of human behavior directly results in damaging public policy.
There's a fundamental theology there that says, if we're going to say people are sinful and fallen, it has to be on that person. It can't be that they can't, quote unquote, blame other things and so forth. So all of this is reflected in what Trump is doing. So what do you do if you want to stop crime? You go in and you attack the criminals. What do you do if you want to address homelessness? Go disperse the homeless, because I don't know where he thinks they're going to go. You disperse them to where, but, you know, suddenly they're going to go out and get jobs. But what do you see? You see demands for work requirements and different kinds of things like this. So you see that, and that blindness and that unwillingness to recognize the social dimensions of these issues, I think this is part of why it resonates with huge swaths of American conservatives, because this is how they understand the nature of human relationships and human behavior and human moral responsibility. And so I think all of that is there. There's also obviously a political interest, because guess what? Fixing society is expensive. You would have to like actually spend money to do things like helping people and so forth. And we don't want to do that. So we have a vested interest in making sure that we blame individuals.
Wow.
Yep. That's intense.
Yep.
What do you think, Sharon?
You know, I often think about when I was a teenager and, you know, to make money, we would babysit or we would shovel snow, even me, you know, just to make money.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I don't see teenagers out doing that. I see grown men coming from the other side of town with shovels and they come around and they knock on doors and they're looking for work.
Yep.
And in the same vein, I have hired someone to clean my house just every other week, and I do not know if she's a citizen or not.
Right.
And yet it doesn't matter to me, because if someone was a citizen and came to me and said, hey, I'll clean your house, then I'd be happy to hire them. But that doesn't happen.
Right. Right. I mean, look, certainly, certainly we need what immigrants are offering us. But going back to the, you know, the idea of public policy being influenced by this view of human behavior being an individual choice and completely overlooking the social dynamics that create the conditions that make those behaviors come about. We completely somehow disconnect from the social analysis, which, look, you know, 3,000 years before they had air conditioning, I could understand people not having access to the research. They didn't have access to a social scientific framework. But we've got it now. And the, you know, the lag that this is taking to actually change the way we think about each other is really dangerous, because things are moving so fast and we're not keeping up. You know, we have these, all of these existential threats, and unless we recognize that, okay, there's a climate shift going on, it's resulting in climate immigration. We're getting climate immigrants, and it's resulting in populists worldwide, authoritarian populists being empowered, and they are destabilizing, and they can create conditions for one country to aggress on another, and it's only a matter of time before the nuclear button is pushed. I mean, so there are all these interweaving factors that unless we are guided by science and social science, we're going to keep getting it wrong.
You know, it brings me back to what you've written about in Naturalistic Support, this idea of blame and our inclination to assume that others are responsible for what they do wrong, that they're worthy of blame, that we ourselves are guilty and worthy of bad fortune if we think we've done bad things, that we're less than we should be.
Yeah, yeah.
This notion that judgment is somehow almost satisfying, that there's something attractive about the idea of condemning others and assuming that they deserve what they're getting, and maybe even the idea of beating up on ourselves for that we deserve it because we have violated these rules.
Yeah, yeah. I have another clip, last clip from Straight White American Jesus podcast, where Professor Miller discusses how the Trump presidency is completely consistent with the right-wing Christian view of God.
That model, that narcissistic authoritarian power, that's what God is on the right. Donald Trump is doing exactly what the right says that God does. Exercising authority and punishing and smiting and coming along and identifying wrongdoers and like casting them away and all of those kinds of things, that's what the right-wing authoritarian God does. That's what the God that millions of Americans worship and have worshiped for decades and decades and decades, that's what that God is. That's what that God is defined as. God is defined as power. God's primary attribute on the right, it is not love. It is not compassion. It is order, power, will, right? God imposing order. What defines that order? God's will and God's authority and God's power. And God will, you know, in the biblical language, smite anybody who stands in the way of that. And when you talk to people on the right, and I've had this conversation and you've had this conversation and we've read the books and we've listened to the sermons and we've done all of those things, you say, well, yeah, but like, doesn't it say in the Bible that like God is love? And they'll say, well, yeah, of course. Brad, of course God is love, but that love is never going to contravene divine law. that love is never going to contravene obedience to a supreme divine will. It's about absolute obedience, the exercise of authority. And you look at, you know, what Bible passages, what Bible stories do they want to tell? It's not Jesus like telling the woman to go and sin no more after he protects her from being stoned by people who would accuse her. It's not somebody coming along and saying, oh, there's neither Jew or, you know, Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female. Everybody's welcome in the kingdom of God. No, it's not that. It's we're going to knock down the walls of Jericho and we're going to occupy, you know, the promised land. And we're going to take what God says is ours and we're going to use force to do it. And, you know, all of these kinds of things. So when Trump does this, this is exactly what, again, a deep religious resonance says power and authority is. When you are angry, you punish people.
Yeah.
Pretty horrifying.
Yeah. That makes sense, right?
Yep.
You know, from a naturalistic humanist point of view, just the fact that a religion, any religion, has the capacity to justify such a malevolent agenda makes it dangerous and incompatible with progressive values. If a religion can be so easily and perilously misinterpreted, then an entirely new understanding is needed. We want to hear what you think about this, listeners. Our number is 212-209-2877. And we'd like to hear if you think we need to think about God in a different way than so many of our fellow countrymen are thinking about it. State-of-the-art science tells us that the need for revenge is a highly problematic mental state, actually similar to a gambling or a drug addiction. Now, given this, worshiping a god who seeks revenge is hard to understand. Now, last week, one of our callers, Francis from Fishkill, New York, mentioned the work of James Kimmel Jr. He's a Yale psychiatry lecturer, an attorney, and the author of the recently published book, The Science of Revenge: Understanding the World's Deadliest Addiction and How to Overcome It. If you're listening, Francis, thank you for that. Really appreciate it. Kimmel's work explains the many problems which result from a need to take revenge. I'd like to play a clip from an interview where Kimmel was being interviewed. It's the Strategy Skills podcast. He was being interviewed this past June. So some very interesting stuff about revenge addiction.
The pleasure and reward circuitry of the brain that activates for other addictions like, you know, narcotics addiction and gambling addiction, behavioral addictions, activates for revenge seeking. And so we begin pretty quickly to see that this area is called the nucleus accumbens, which is kind of the craving area of the brain, and the dorsal striatum, which is the habit formation part of the brain. Those two areas activate. And dopamine begins to surge inside the brain, which is the pleasure that you're getting from even thinking about retaliating. So retaliation is pleasurable at first, but then this dopamine level, it drops pretty quickly. And when it drops, this leaves you in this state of wanting or craving more. And what you're wanting or craving more of is retaliation. Revenge, you get this temporary dopamine high. It covers up the pain for, you know, minutes, an hour, 2 hours, something like that. But it doesn't last long. With forgiveness, on the other hand, it takes the pain away altogether. It's like the most amazing, I mean, we really need to think of forgiveness as a wonder drug. Because it actually takes away pain. It doesn't just cover it up. The second thing that it does besides shutting down that anterior insula is it also shuts down the pleasure and reward circuitry of addiction. So it also stops activation in that nucleus accumbens in the dorsal striatum area of addiction. And that's really important because it now is taking away these nagging cravings to go and, you know, plan some retaliatory event. The neuroscience shows that forgiving a grievance or forgiving somebody who has wronged you is not of benefit to the person who wronged you. It's of benefit to you. It is, you know, in American society, we're very scornful of forgiveness. We think it's a weak way to respond, or that it's going to open yourself up to repeated attacks and abuse. That's not true at all. This has nothing to do with self-defense. You can absolutely defend yourself and leave a toxic relationship, or defend yourself from a present threat of future harm. But this is a way to heal yourself from trauma and wrongs of the past by using your own brain's healing circuitry.
And we actually have a caller on the line, so let's take that. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
My name is Bob, and I'm calling from Long Island.
Bob from Long Island. How are you?
I'm okay. I missed the beginning of the show, so I wasn't sure about the topic being about the way God is perceived, or traditionally how God is perceived as playing into a whole kind of neo-Christian right-wing kind of,
Bob, despite you missing the beginning, you got it.
Yeah, so I was originally going to call in and say, like, you want to role play? I'll play the blue-collar guy who's down on the immigrants, and I can give you every reason why he feels justified in portraying them as, you know, villains or, like, you know, terrorists or whatever, you know, the thing is. But I mean, it all plays into the same thing, you know, the fear of losing what we already have or the fear of not getting what we need. And that's something that is easily played on, you know, with, you know, to capitalize on that and exploit it. But as far as the religion part of it goes, you know, people are always citing the Bible as proof of something, and they can customize it. And, you know, Chuck Kirk did this, I think. I'm not familiar with his tactics, but it's the oldest trick in the book, because you can't argue against the Bible. The ultimate authority. And, you know, but the Bible is often used as a way to kind of complement or to use as definitive proof of your point of view, which is usually to disparage somebody else or to denigrate them, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, part of what we're trying to examine is there's got to be another way to think about, if we're thinking about the most powerful, omniscient, wise, knowledgeable force in the universe, certainly we might be able to imagine them as not being ignorant of everything that we have learned from social science about the human experience. Maybe, you know, picture a God that is not judgmental, empathetic, not conditional in love, but unconditionally loving. It would seem that there are a lot of ways we can re-envision God that would be more consistent with a naturalistic humanist understanding.
I think it has to come from lived experience, that empathy can't necessarily come about as an exercise in imagination, especially for people who aren't geared to or wired that way, or having been brought up to think that way. So empathy is pretty much, I think, the cornerstone of any sort of great change, be it personal or societal.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would think that if every American gets to spend, like, you know, a month in Somalia, you know, then they would change. Or if they lived in Gaza, or if they lived in, you know, anywhere where people were suffering.
Well, unfortunately, that's not going to happen, but if we keep on going the way we are, we're going to create plenty of suffering to go around here. So maybe as people start to suffer, they will recognize that their interests are on the line. I don't think we're going to have to go to those places. We're going to, there's going to be
plenty. I'm just saying, because the point of the show, I guess, is what I'm hearing is how do we collectively change the paradigm so we can become a more loving, empathic place instead of one that's based upon, you know, the old age-old vindictiveness and success, you know, from triumph and rewards, of, you know, for being the most aggressive mixed martial artist.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, unfortunately, we're dealing with, you know, patriarchy is, you know, based upon the fact that, you know, might makes right. And if we don't go away, you know, Trump is just, you know, an amazing, you know, he just, for me, he displays the inevitability of the American culture that was kind of etched into our kind of social DNA.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that that's inevitable. You know, it seems like that's a possible outcome, and it's the outcome that we have right now. But ultimately, I don't know if that's inevitable. I hope it's not.
I think it is. The inevitability is pretty much, you know, proven by its own existence. It wouldn't have happened if it wasn't inevitable.
Well, yeah, but it's not the end of the story yet. So
no, absolutely not. You know, the curve of history, blah blah blah. Cybernetic, but, you know, might take thousands of years, you know, or maybe, you know, let's say the best thing happened. How do we demagnify people? How helpful would that take? What would it take?
Yeah, well, it just seems like maybe we can start by reimagining a more loving God. Bob, we have another call that we got to get to, but thank you for checking in. Appreciate it.
Great call. Really fascinating.
You're listening to Naturalistic Support right here on 99.5 FM. WBAI New York.
Non-commercial, listener-sponsored.
Peace and Justice Radio.
On Wednesdays from 2 to 3, Naturalistic Support is taking listener calls, offering a revolutionary new way to think about ourselves and reach out to each other.
I just wanted to call in to give encouragement to the last caller.
It hit right on where I am right at this moment.
You really hit the proverbial nail on the head.
I really connected with what you were saying about loneliness.
We are hardwired to help each other.
Getting past the blame, owning your own truth, letting go of judgmental thoughts.
I felt so fortunate to hear this.
You went through every single one of the things that I've been working on with my life. Now you said all that, I'm like, holy cow, what is this guy doing? Is he talking to me right now?
The Naturalistic Revolution is a game changer. Listen to us break it down on Wednesdays from 2 to 3.
I want to thank you so much. You helped me so much.
Yeah.
Elaine, you want to take our next caller?
Sure. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
Hi, is that me?
Yeah, that's you.
Oh, okay. My name is Charlie, Long Island. I was listening to you before about the religions and stuff and how they, you know, they're totally brainwashed in doing this. And I want to point out that all religions, a lot of religions deal with this. And it's a shame because I think most people who are involved with religious life are better than that. But the point I wanted to make was the non-religious people, the secular people, are basically driven, I believe, by the ideology of social Darwinism, which is not Darwinism. I don't think it's based on science either. It's Spencer. Everybody heard the phrase survival of the fittest, right? That comes from social Darwinism. It's not Darwinism. I don't think it's believed by it's supported by science either. But anyway,
Larry,
that's
what gives you that impression?
Oh, just my studies of fascism over the years. I mean, just the idea, you know, just the saying itself, survival of the fittest, you know, it's a crazy saying. It's taking that, it's not even acknowledging that life is partially cooperation.
Like absolutely. What about the idea of secular humanism? Where you aspire without God to morality, to kindness, to loving your fellow human being.
Sure. And when you have a saying like, you know, survival of the fittest, it just takes that all out. It's just a one-sided view. Like, you know, you got, and, you know, a kid, you know, somebody hears this, you know, it's not too healthy for them.
Yeah, anyway, Charlie, I just want to say one thing about survival of the fittest. You know, survival of the fittest is a problematic concept if we define fitness as the biggest and the baddest, you know, and the most ruthless competitor is the one that wins. But that's not what fitness is. To be the fittest, you actually do have to be the most successful cooperator. Think of a tribe of primates. The fittest, the most successful, is the guy that does favors, the primate that does favors for all the other primates in the tribe.
Exactly.
And ultimately, that's the one that leads, because that's fitness. Fitness is taking care of the environment and those around you. And so we need a different concept of fitness.
Sure. I mean, I hate that saying. And in fact, there were studies a few years back about altruism and how people who help people actually live longer. But anyway, you know, with the ideology of social Darwinism, if you take a look at Hitler and Nazism, basically they're saying, I mean, that ideology basically says the weak have to die so that the strong can live on. So they actually killed, in Nazi Germany, they actually killed handicapped people.
Yeah.
Today, they can't do that.
Right.
Okay, the fascists today can't do that. So what they do is they attack Medicare, Medicaid, and things like that, and do it very subtly.
Yeah.
I believe that ideology is alive well today, and people should look into that and see what they're fighting.
Yeah, I think so much of this really comes from religion. I don't think, I think that the whole concept that humans are naturally inclined towards sin, we're naturally selfish, we're naturally competitive, we're naturally unwilling to contribute unless we're coerced, that negative view of human nature, that really pessimistic view of human nature, you know, I think originally it originates with religion, but then kind of capitalism sort of takes it and changes it a little and says, you know, deep down inside we're all corrupt, we're all greedy, but it's just a spin on that age-old, you know, misanthropic view. But I think that our social science is giving us a much more accurate view, and it's what it's saying is that we are inclined toward cooperation and caring and participating and contributing. The key is that we get developmentally supported so that our human potential will flourish. And I think that that's what social science tells us, Charlie. So I think that we can get that without religion.
makes a really interesting point that, you know, like you've pointed out, in religion, there are those who believe in love and kindness and believe in a loving God, and there are those who believe in a disciplinarian, the stern hand, the punishing hand. That amongst the secular, and I'm an ethical culturalist, so I put myself in that group, there are also those divides between, like you say, survival of the fittest versus a humanistic, loving attitude.
Sure.
That these divides occur in just about every group.
Yeah, but I must say, Elaine, that I think that for people who are secular and who say that they are influenced by science, if they have this misanthropic view of human nature, they're simply not paying attention to the science. They're not paying attention to what the science is telling us. Charlie, thank you for your call. We have another call on the line we have to get to. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Gwen.
Gwen.
In East Harlem.
Yep.
And I've been living here for a long time. And I want to say that I got caught on something you said earlier in the program. And I hear this very, very frequently. I want to say that I am very far to the left. I'm a Democrat. But I really take issue when I hear people say that these jobs are just jobs that no American will do. And that's a bunch of crap. You know, I remember in early 2000s, I would fight with Republicans and not really understand why they wanted all the illegal immigrants to stay here. And the reason why they wanted them to stay here is because they were exploiting their employment. They were paying them less than they would pay somebody who was American to do that job. And so I wanted to be known that, you know, I live in a very low-income area. It's a very struggling area. I know many, many people here that want to work, but they won't let you exploit their work, particularly African-American people. They're not going to let you exploit them and pay them $3 for a job that should pay $15. And my family is in the building industry, the building business. And, you know, my father always had good, reliable workers. They were American workers, and he always paid them the right going rate, what the going rate was. But, you know, it was really hard for American workers to stay where they were when the competition was now accepting $15 an hour for a job that paid $25 an hour. And I think the left does not do a good job on really examining all this. This started out in a very exploitative way, saying that, you know what, we can take advantage of them because they're not American.
Gwen, I agree with you. I agree with you that immigrants are exploited and if many jobs that we think of as only immigrants wanting to do were paid, were compensated appropriately, then a much wider group of people would definitely be applying for those jobs. No question about that. But what do you think about our topic, Gwen? Do you have any ideas
about God?
Yeah.
And I want to say this too, that, you know, I just had this conversation last night. I grew up in a Christian household, but I did not grow up in I grew up in a Protestant household, not a Catholic household. And half of my family is Catholic. So the Catholic side of our family believes that there will be divine retribution. I often hear people around me say things like, God don't like ugly. Well, God doesn't like ugly. But I'm not really sure God weighs in on the things that we do, and it also is going to intervene on the things that we do in this lifetime. You are here to make your mistakes, and these mistakes are going to hurt. I don't think that when you die, there's somebody over you judging you. And that doesn't often make me feel good, because I see terrible people like Donald Trump. That makes me, you know, I don't think that when he dies that he will necessarily go to hell or anything bad will happen to him. He's a horrible person. He is destroying this country.
He may cease to exist when he dies, which is seems like a very likely outcome. Right? I mean, we might cease to exist.
Oh, his impact.
But I don't think God is up there metering out punishment.
I agree.
It's up to you to follow the moral guidelines that we've been given.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the gift is you did it. The gift is it takes more self-restraint to do it, more patience to do it, But you know what? You can put your head on the pillow at night and you can go to sleep because your conscience is clear. I don't think Trump sleeps too well.
Yeah. Gwen, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. Call us again.
Gwen makes a really good point, too, that sleep works better with a relaxed goodwill, forgiveness for a more humane attitude tends to make you more relaxed. It makes for better health.
Yeah.
It makes for better breathing. It makes for better heart health than vindictiveness and anger and rage and...
Yeah, absolutely. The neuroscience of feeling, peaceful and loving thoughts is that's healthy. I mean, as we just heard Dr. James Kimmel saying, forgiveness has even a greater effect on the person doing the forgiving than the person receiving the forgiveness.
Yeah, psychologically and physically, measurable.
Yep, yep. We have another caller on the line, so let's get to that. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling? Where are you calling from?
This is Mike calling from Manhattan.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
All right, yourself?
All right, sir.
Just good, just good. You know, I think it's also upbringing, and then whose God is the right God? I mean, with everything that's happened in like the last 9 months, just to see people sit around and just like think everything's okay, it's like whose God is the right God? I mean, I've met people that are Luciferians. They believe Lucifer is a God. Now, who am I to judge? Who am I to not? I tend to be more spiritual because I look at, you know, it seems like the world is so disconnected, or the people of the world are so disconnected. Like, what happened to common decency and just compassion for your fellow man or woman?
Yeah, well, Mike, there are a lot of people who believe that they are, you know, doing God's work on this earth. And God's work is dismantling our government, cutting out these programs that people depend on, and deporting immigrants. And they believe, you know, there's a large swath of this country that believes that's completely consistent with the God that they worship. And that's what this program's about. We're saying maybe there's a problem with those assumptions, those attributes that they are assigning to the God that they imagine. Maybe we need to think of God differently.
That term that Mike used, sure, Luciferian,
yeah,
that's really interesting because it sounds like a closer identification of this punishing God.
Well, yeah. A Satanist, is that the same thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, well, somebody who's worshiping Lucifer, which is a particular demon.
Remember, Lucifer was one of God's favorite angels. Lucifer was a singer.
Yeah.
You know, he carried music, and I look at the disconnect as crazy because I grew up Roman Catholic as a child. I was the altar boy. I go back to when it was parochial school, and I just look at the disconnect, like from Pat Robinson up until now, from Paul Robinson up until now. And it's just like some people don't have that memory, don't have that history because they're not that old. Yeah. You know, I'm my age. But it's just like, where's the love at?
Yeah.
You know, where's the love? Just common decency. What happened? I just don't get it. And we can't just blame Trump because it's not just Trump. We got to talk about Steve Miller and Peter Thiel.
Beyond any of those individuals, maybe we have to look at the belief system, right? Because, you know, blaming individuals, the problem is if we got rid of all those people tomorrow, there's a very good chance that they would be replaced by similar people who we don't even know their names. But, you know, the problem is if our society allows this or causes this to happen, we have to examine what is it in our belief system that allows people like that to ascend to power. And Mike, we have another call we got to get to, so we have to move on. But thank you for your call.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
All right. You too. Elaine, why don't you take this one?
Sure. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
Hey, Artie, calling out of Queens, New York. Good afternoon.
Hi.
What was your name again?
Oh, Arthur.
Arthur. Hey, Arthur.
I'm so glad you that the gentleman before me had mentioned it's some of the people around him. I'm watching a lot of what's happening. We all are. And we can't just say, you know who, because there's an awful lot of people around him. When I look at the young Republicans, I think, who are online with the emails, I wonder, I mean, was Hitler so long ago that you're putting it like it happened back in the, you know, 1600s or something? I'm like, well, how can you make jokes like that?
Yeah.
Or Steve Miller and the whole rest of them, this whole, are they forgetting this, or are they just never wanted to even hear it, you know, from the get-go?
Yeah, but Arthur, let's not get, again, caught up in the individuals, because like I said, there are 1,000 Steve Millers waiting to ascend to that level of power. There are 1,000 Donald Trumps, even though he is pretty unique, but there are others. And the problem, we have to look at how we can immunize ourselves as a culture from those kind of damaging people with damaging narratives.
Because you said something earlier, and I'm so sorry, but it's true. Yes, there were people who committed euthanasia in Germany. They you know, or whatever, they considered that, well, you're crippled, you're taking up space, and they just killed them.
Yeah.
And my feeling is that there are people, they won't put it in those words, but they feel the exact same way. It's like when we talk about South Africa and apartheid, we have to remember, and a lot of times we don't. They traveled through the South in the 1930s, and that would help them, hey, this ain't bad, and took it back to South Africa, even though, you know, they were doing it already, but they pretty much that whole...
But 1948, they kind of made it into law in a way that it hadn't been before. And yes, they were, just like Hitler, was highly inspired, you know, reading Ford's Dearborn Independent, you know, just trashing Jews. I mean, Hitler was inspired by America. And
I don't mean to interrupt, but from what I read, Hitler was inspired by the playbook of the Jim Crow South.
Yep, Jim Crow South as well.
And that is where Hitler got his idea from.
Yep, that too.
He got his idea from us.
Yep.
And I think over time, politicians have been tapping into those people who kind of want the South to rise again.
Yeah.
And they kind of want that separatism. And unfortunately, I think that never went away. And I think that's scary to think about.
Yeah. I think you're 100%
with the wind.
Yeah, 100% right. Yeah.
And you know, those symbols, you know, with the Confederate flag. People put that out, they say, "Oh, it's my culture, it's my this," but it's as offensive to a person of color as a swastika is to a person who's Jewish.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, that we have to figure out a new way to think about God, a new way to think about the human experience, and in a way that is consistent with stopping blaming and stopping hating and being humble and a little bit more empathetic and kinder. And I think it's possible. I think, you know, in naturalistic humanism, we don't, it's not focused in the way other secular naturalistic practices are, being focused on someone not believing in God or not believing in the afterlife. If people want to believe in God or the afterlife, that's fine, but it's important that we reimagine a God that is beyond revenge and judgmental thinking and all the, you know, all the damaging things that make religion so dangerous.
Can I leave you, because I know you got other calls, but the thing, can I leave you with this?
Yeah.
Is it just me, but every time the Pope turns around and says, as you're speaking now about our fellow man and the poor, that seemed to be the time when quite a few people figured, oh, he needs to shut up.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Yeah. Like,
yep. The Pope. Yeah. Arthur, thank you for your call. Call us again. And we've actually got to wrap it up, you guys.
Wow.
That was fast.
Too soon. Too quick.
Too soon. Too young.
But a good reminder that we've got a very humanistic Pope.
Yeah, absolutely. We're on the right track Pope-wise, which is great. All right, we're going to ask also that people consider becoming a WBAI buddy. Go to buddy.wbai.org and specify that you are supporting naturalistic support. And we very much would appreciate that. All right. You've been listening to Naturalistic Support's look at God and judgmental thinking. I'm Arnell Doray, and today we were joined by Elaine Durbach and Sharon Stanley. Thanks, Elaine and Sharon.
Oh, it was fascinating.
It really was. There's so much more to talk about.
Sure is. And thanks to our talented engineer, Red Johnson, and to Hilla Weiss for her support. Tune in again next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for another edition of our program. Archived editions of Naturalistic Support can be found on our website at wbai.org and at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Hi to my foster mom, Marilyn. And stay where you are, because coming right up is the Katie Halper Show. And remember, always try to be kind, because you never really know what someone else is going through.
Should will you be the one? I got a little question I'd like to ask.